You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 48. This minute opens with Shaw looking on in fascination at the true face of the engineer, and ends with David looking concerned as the head seems to come to life. And, continuing on from the previous episode, I still have Philip here from the Matrix Minute.
Yes, it is I. Hello!
So I think this scene is one of the key ones for this film. I think most movies, there should be at least three moments or like set pieces that really stick with you that sort of tie into that thesis.
This is definitely one of them.
Oh yeah, it's the creation, coming face to face with the creator, and then you've got these elements of Frankenstein.
And, oh yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, which obviously becomes a bigger influence in Covenant. Noticing any sort of Frankenstein illusion in Prometheus suddenly makes me go, oh, I see where you were going. I think Ridley really was thinking ahead.
The modern day Prometheus, right?
Or the modern day Prometheus. Yeah, I think a lot of people tend to dismiss Ridley because they go, oh, well, he's clearly just making it up as he goes along, or why does he make these choices or whatever. And I think he fascinates me because I cannot say for certain why he does what he does, but I enjoy a lot of it. And
what did you think of Robin Hood?
Couldn't get through it. So boring.
Okay, cool. Good.
Yeah.
All right, continue.
I was hoping to at least enjoy it, but I think he really does have a vision for Alien that is kind of obscure, and he got a weird way of approaching it, but I'm so riveted. And that's why I would love to see a third film, because it's like, what are you doing? Where is this going? I'm so on board for this.
Yeah, you and I may have very similar opinions on Prometheus. Unfortunately, our opinions will differ when it comes to Covenant. Unfortunately.
Well, I would be happy to have you on, because this show is all about pulling these stories apart and trying to weigh those pros and cons. So I welcome it.
Makes sense. But then again, I would definitely like a third one. So, because I believe in the redemption. I believe that you can still do a good job. Okay.
Honestly, yeah, I've been giving a lot of thought to that too recently, just in terms of Prometheus flips Alien on its head. Covenant flips Prometheus on its head. So the third one could come along and just turn that table over again.
And turn it into Alien.
Yeah, and we'll come full circle.
Yeah, 360.
My attitude to these films at this point is just like, whee, where are we going?
Yeah, I agree. I actually kind of agree with you there. Yeah, exactly. Like, where are we going with this?
How I learned to stop worrying and embrace Ridley Scott's uneven vision for a beloved franchise.
Yes. He's turning senile. He's just off the rails.
Oh, I want to be like him when I'm that old. He's so cool.
Man, he don't care no more. He don't care. He's just gonna speak his mind. Doesn't matter.
Look, I created this film, and that's just how it is.
I cannot do a Ridley Scott impression, and that breaks my heart. Maybe I should work more at it.
My brother Jake, one of the co-hosts of the Matrix Minute, I think he did it once in one of our episodes. I can do like a second grade Ridley Scott.
So, as mentioned in the previous minute, since the 1970s practically, we've had very strange versions of the space jockey, most of them being this sort of elephantine, literal interpretation of the space jockey. Thing is, though, from the beginning,
I do raise my hand at interruption and say I do love the elephant guy. I do. I love him.
Yeah, for me, that was one of the most important scenes in Alien, and that's what stood out to me and stuck with me and Giga. He always said that it was intended to be a spacesuit. So at least that's canonical, but what's under there? It was anyone's guess, and I'll put this in the footnotes, actually. Alien series, I mean, I think every Alien podcast and YouTube channel does take reference from this very great website. They did an article back in 2015 which was all about what we knew about the jockeys and how they were presented in the expanded lore. And I really do find that stuff interesting. I know we've talked about it a little bit in the previous minute, but just what do we make of all this expanded stuff? And what place does it have in the overall story? I think my conclusion is this is modern myth-making. So you've got, you know, some people over here, this tribe, they've got this story about Hercules, but then you've got the tribe over here who one night around the campfire, the village elder was like, "Ooh, thought of a new one." So he adds a little new detail, maybe forgets a bit, and then he comes up with a new explanation as to why you're not supposed to do this with magic or whatever it is, or gives Hercules more trials than other stories do. So I feel like ultimately what stories should do is entertain us, educate us, and kind of serve as a cultural or collective memory, which is why to this day we make pop culture references as kind of a shorthand and it's a means of communication. So whether you think this story has these elements or doesn't really matter. I think as long as we're getting some sort of enjoyment out of it. And that's why I would never dismiss someone going, "Oh, well, I prefer the elephant." And it's like, yeah, cool. Like, if you're getting something out of that, cool. It's probably not going to happen in the movies because the direction the movies are going. I think if people, yeah, dig their heels and go, "No, nuts wrong. There must be some other kind of space jockey." Well, no. This scene right here lets us know that these movies in particular are going with this engineer look. And hey, maybe one day Neil Blomkamp might get his chance at doing an alien film and we might get an actual space jockey.
Oh, the Neil Blomkamp thing. Oh boy, yeah, I don't know what you think about that. I mean, this is a podcast of segues, I assume. Because I'm going to start talking about that now. Okay.
No. Yeah, because Neil Blomkamp has made precisely one good movie and tried to make it over and over again.
I love District 9.
Yeah,
but I didn't see any of the other ones.
Yeah, Chappie and all that. It's basically the same movie, but not as good.
Okay. I mean, I haven't seen them because the trailers made it feel like, is this District 9? So I never really, unfortunately, I just never gotten around to, it never interested me enough to see them because it just felt like preachy. That's what it felt like just by the trailer.
Yeah. He's not known for subtlety. That's my biggest problem is, well, District 9 works because we just hadn't seen anything like that before. And it was preachy, but the story and the effects were so riveting.
But it looked so good. Yeah, and I thought that it had, like, dark humor in it. Like, it really did have a sense of humor, and I think that's what made me like it so much.
As for, well, we don't know a lot of details about what his alien film would have been. I don't know how I feel about bringing back Ripley after all these years. To me, the way
she... I totally agree.
The way she died in Alien 3 is so fucking badass. Like, she just sacrifices herself, and then the alien queen fetus comes out of her chest, and then she's like, "Nah, bitch, we're going down together," and then they just melt.
Yeah,
like, and Terminator.
It's like a catharsis to what she had to endure for like three movies, especially the third one. And it feels like it's a statement to the third film as well. It's like, look at this nightmare that we've created. I'm not talking about the events in the film as much as just the production of, you know, like the intent of Alien 3, that it was, you know, it was supposed to be something it's not, and it just turns into a hodgepodge, and it was semi-salvaged by someone who knew what he was doing early on and, you know, wasn't able to do what he wanted because of all this confusion that became that film. And it's a catharsis in seeing this ending, you know, concluding it, you know, completely. And I think it works for both the story and the backstory of the film as well.
I don't want to, like, that was really nicely put, and I don't want to ruin it with gross words, but I say Alien 3 is a constipated film, but the last 10 minutes, it gets it out. The last 10 minutes, you're like, it's all wrapped up.
It is.
It happened. We got it.
Yeah, let's just keep it like that.
Yeah, the real heartbreaking, crushing, brutal reality that is the end of Alien 3. And I'm so protective of that.
The music is so good. Elliot Goldenthal's music at the end.
Yeah, so the idea of resurrecting Noom, sort of referencing an alien film, resurrecting Ripley yet again.
And Michael
Biehn. Especially at this point, we've had this happen with the Terminator films especially. I'm just really burned.
Thank you. That's exactly why I don't like this idea, is because we've seen this sort of thing before. We've had people return to roles that they were known for decades ago. And honestly, the magic doesn't happen as often as you would think it does, just because someone's back to play a part again.
The only resurrection of Ripley I will accept is there is a skit on the Colbert Report where Ripley is that she can feel the chest burst is about to come out, and she goes into this hospital, and the receptionist is Stephen Colbert, and it's obviously a take on the American healthcare system. And there's all this bureaucracy and stuff that she has to deal with. It's like, it is coming out now. And if that happens, he's like, hang on a minute. So is it two P's in your surname or is it one? Okay, yeah.
I've never heard of that. Wow.
Which I should put
that's
in the footnote.
Crazy. Oh, man.
Yeah, I think you can definitely do that sort of thing in a comedic way. But when you're trying to recapture the magic in a serious film, nah, it's just not going to happen. And
it's not going to happen, but I feel like the only way it's going to happen is if you acknowledge that these characters have to have changed after so long. We can't have the same person we have from the old films, you know what I mean? And I'm not talking like Alien Resurrection.
So Neil Blomkamp clearly has this attitude of, well, I liked Aliens the best, and I really want to continue Aliens. And it becomes Aliens fan fiction. And a lot of fans will get excited about that, and that will get shared around on the geek websites, and it will generate a lot of attention. And I'm just sitting there going, but actually imagine this happening, guys.
Yes. Imagine it happening. What are we going to get from it? Like, what's the point? From the concept art that I saw, by the way, I'm very jealous because, you know, Neil Blomkamp can show his unfinished movie concepts and people will say, that looks awesome, but when I do it, okay, never mind. That's another segue. Then again, I don't show it because I believe people will say that, so joke's on me. When you're showing this concept art, from what I've seen, there's like a queen in a space hull, like this big warehouse with some... And it seems like people captured or like transported the old LV-426 ship, right? Stuff like that. And then there's Hicks with a scar. By the way, where's Newt? Is Newt going to be dead? Because that's just negating the whole point of the ending of Aliens anyway. You're just turning...
And Bishop, yeah.
Yeah, and Bishop. So I don't... So it's like it just...
I would have loved it if Bishop has just like... like in the Wild Wild West movie, he's got like the little spider legs.
Oh no. What does he do? What is he? Is he like just like, according to my calculations, oh, we're almost, he's like, what's happening in this film? Like, I understand that it's fun to look at, and but I can't see it going anywhere. And I remember that there was like this Ripley having this alien suit, which it doesn't feel like this is like the antithesis of Prometheus, where Prometheus is actually using like, just it just feels more artistic. It just feels like there's something that you're exploring in Prometheus that feels substantial over the Neil Blomkamp thing that was very superficial because of how like an alien suit and the guns and the alien queen and the I don't even know. Do you know what I mean?
I think you've really hit the nail on the head there in terms of the Neil Blomkamp thing feels like a fan project. It is derivative and it's idealistic.
Yeah.
Whereas because fans, they can't make the hard decisions. You see this in fan fiction all the time where...
That's the thing, man.
Oh, but what if the characters were like best friends and they got to be a family that lived together forever and nothing bad ever happened? Well, okay, but look at something like Frankenstein. If you were to write an alternate ending where the creature lives happily ever after...
Whoa, spoiler! Just kidding.
Yeah. You just be like, oh, yeah, I guess that was an okay story. It would be forgotten about. I don't think we'd still be talking about Frankenstein to this day if there wasn't that tragedy. Or Alien, if all the characters managed to get through to the end of that film, they defeated the xenomorph, you know, that happily ever after. Eh?
Yeah, it wouldn't have that impact.
Yeah, and I feel like this Neil Blomkamp project would have been like that. It would have been trying to fix everything and really be fan servicey without real substance. It's the Ready Player One of the Alien universe.
That's what it seems like. That's a very good connection you made there.
There is artistic merit to Prometheus and even Alien Covenant because no one was asking for this. This wasn't commercially inspired. They didn't have this commercial obligation, whereas something like Star Wars, that's a hot commodity. That's something that is really going to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Aliens was never that sort of property. And so it really was just Ridley Scott going, I want to do this, actually. I really have some ideas. I want to continue in this world. And he's not doing anything to please anyone. Like the whole David creating the xenomorph or the space jockey is actually this Grecian looking man. No one even imagined that until he went there.
Yeah. So since I'm in another episode, I will definitely want to talk about what my thoughts were after seeing the film and how I felt like it could have gone further than it actually did in the movie, in the finished film. But you just have to remind me next time. But in this case, I wanted to say that what fans' expectations for sequels are, I don't, like, it's just really difficult to tap into really what they want, because I know they want things that are familiar, and so do I. You know, like, I will admit, I don't know what you think about Jurassic World, the first one.
I haven't seen them.
But, okay. But when I first saw Jurassic World, I thought it was fun because it was goofy and dumb, but it was great because it had all those references.
Yeah. You know,
I was so happy about the references because I haven't heard of these references being referenced for years. So I was like, ah, the thing that I know, I like it, you know? But then watching the film again and again, and then realizing that I hated this film. So there's something about what people's expectations versus other people's, like the filmmakers in this case, ambition to make something new, which can clash very violently if you don't know how to handle it properly.
You definitely see that with the Star Wars property. It's really interesting to see. Like, I loved The Last Jedi, but it was a divisive film. I was not expecting it because I saw it of opening day, I think. So I just went, wow, I really loved a Star Wars movie. I genuinely was surprised by a Star Wars film. Because I think for me, well, I mean, those stories are classic mythology. It's all very basic storytelling. And so for this one,
yeah, it's supposed to be like an adventure serial. Hmm. So,
and for The Last Jedi to really subvert expectations the way it did, and to go in really surprising directions in terms of choices and tone and all that, I was just like, whoa, I'm suddenly really invested in this. But the backlash was so aggressive. And I realized that it's actually reflective of, I think, a collective psychology that is going on right now. That it is a scary time. It is an uncertain time. And we really want nostalgia. Like, nostalgia is a big commodity right now in terms of, you know, rebooting these films. Yeah. Or like the Marvel movies are just comfort food. It is just a comfort blanket.
That is the best term I've ever heard. Well done. Like, seriously, that is so true. It's like this comfort food thing. Because I was always having problems about the Marvel films, the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Marvel Studios movies, more officially there. I enjoy watching them, but I don't have any, there's nothing incredibly exceptional about them individually.
I'll give them credit. Like, this is an experiment that's never been undertaken before. And the people who've tried to do this, or the studios that have tried to do the same thing afterwards, have all failed. So they're doing something right. And I think that sort of ties back into my original point, is they are the comfort blanket. They are the nostalgia in a world that is uncertain and scary. And I think, yeah, there is merit to that, but I don't want that in my Alien universe. Alien should be horrible and miserable and depressing, yeah, and existential, and inspire existential crises.
Good, we reel it back to Alien. Yay!
We're back
on track.
So, my notes for this minute is that upon contact...
Oh, finally, we're getting into the minute.
Woo! Yeah, I'm going to edit this to be like super efficient. It's fine. It's great. But I'm glad that we've actually had these discussions about tangential aspects of the Alien franchise, because I don't think I would have had an opportunity to really get into the nitty-gritty of why something like the Blomkamp project just doesn't work, or at least for me personally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, me too.
But why I can understand why there's an audience for that. Upon contact with the air, the engineer seems to spontaneously generate new cells. These dark, cancerous spots emerge on his head.
Mm-hmm.
This is not unlike what we saw happening to the murals in the temple a few minutes back.
Oh, yeah.
I am at a loss for any kind of explanation for this. What is happening?
I don't know. I just thought it was its blood seeping out, honestly. That's all I thought.
That, you know what, when I first saw the film, I just sort of went, oh yeah, it's coming back to life, so I guess, you know, there's something under the skin, that blood or whatever, there's circulation or whatever. But then I went, no, it's doing the exact same thing the murals are. So I guess it's something to do with the mutagen and that it causes this kind of shape-shifting. Well, they actually say it's changing. Changing into what? Like, no one... seems to know, and that's fascinating to me. That
so it is connected, yeah.
And then they all bring it back to life. So the mutagen doesn't affect dead tissue, but if there's even a sliver of life running through that tissue, I'm just thinking out loud here, but yeah,
it's the life juice, definitely, that black goop. But I'm so glad that you talked about the dead tissue, because I've been waiting to talk about this because I wanted to know about your opinion. When they say that this thing seems like it's thousands of years, or was it hundreds? I can't remember.
2,000 years old. The body is exactly, okay, or this head, 2,000 years old. I wonder what that's referring to.
Oh, right, right. I didn't even think of that.
Getting all Jesus up in here.
This is an aspect that I have been thinking of for a while, and I'm so glad that we're here to talk about this in this very long podcast episode. Woo!
It won't be.
It will.
I promise.
It's going to be great. It's going to be fine. I'm enjoying this. This is fun.
Okay.
Okay. The thing about it being 2,000 years old. Okay, you made a good point. But I always thought that this plus the space jockey that we saw in Alien 1, where, like, you know, Dallas looks at it and he's like, fossilized. I always thought that the atmosphere, the environment, the conditions in those planets just have these chemicals in there that make them seem like they're fossilized. It just changes the structure of these bodies. If you're exposed to the elements out there for, I don't know, maybe a couple days, couple weeks, it seems like it was fossilized for thousands of years, but it's not really.
Yeah, so for fossilization, I'm no expert here,
okay,
but...
In this case, no, he's definitely not fossilized, but...
No, that's what I was going to say is, to get that look, though, because so real fossils, I think, is the absence of moisture, you know, dehydrates the body, and then sand.
Mostly rock.
Calcium.
Yes.
So, but in this case, it's a build-up.
I was talking about rock music, but
yeah. It's not the dehydration, of these figures. It is armor, of course, but it seems to be sort of organic. That said, yeah, it feels like there is a build-up of some sort of calcium or something of that description. That stuff you find in the shower when you haven't cleaned it in a while.
Yeah. So,
yeah, maybe we are seeing the effects of the mutagen, that it may be like this sort of bacteria that's moving around freely. Well, we see that it was all over the murals. I don't think they deliberately put it there. It just seeped, and it seeped into the engineer corpses as well. So, huh, maybe we have our answer as to what's happening with this engineer head here.
Mm-hmm. But this is my headcanon, as it were.
Yes.
Where, like, it's just like, I feel like these things aren't really a thought. Like, everybody always talks about, like, the space jockey over there in Alien 1 is, like, 1,000 years old. And I always thought, maybe it's just the elements that made it that way. And it was just, like, a year ago. You know what I mean?
It absolutely could be. And that's happened in science fiction stories before, where they go, this thing is thousands of years old. How could that be? Oh, it's even happened in real life. You've got these conspiracy theories about these unusual fossils and stuff. And what it always turns out to be is that this fossil relic, whatever it is, just happened to be in a very unusual set of circumstances that made it weather a lot faster or a lot slower than would have normally been the case. And whoever found it, moved it, or didn't realize or didn't take into account what the environment might have been like decades, centuries, millennia ago.
Yes, absolutely. So there we go. Validation.
So they begin to slowly run electricity through the head. And yes, some people do find this idea ridiculous. And true, I don't see any reasons in real life for this kind of test. But in this one specific scenario, this is one of the few ways they could get an understanding of how this alien body may have operated when it was alive. So Galvani, back in the early 19th century, yeah, was doing these experiments where, I think a lot of people are aware, he was electrifying frogs, and specifically the frog's legs, which caused muscle contractions, which gave the illusion of life. It's not really life, but it definitely captured the imagination. That's where we get Frankenstein. But from a scientific perspective, I guess you would wonder, does this creature move its face and have facial expressions akin to a human being? Because that's not necessarily a given. Like, apes cannot manipulate their faces in quite the same way human beings do, even though structurally they're very similar.
Yeah, you see, I like that kind of stuff, yes.
Yeah, I think that would be quite interesting if you realize, oh, their eyelids don't blink the same way, or they can't, I don't know, smile or frown the same way we do. So, yeah, I don't think it's ridiculous.
Those are one of the little things that I was thinking of, which we'll talk about in the next episode.
Okay. And yes, of course, on a symbolic level, this is another allusion to Frankenstein, specifically the James Whale film, because the book...
Really?
Yeah, the book Frankenstein does not specify how the creature was brought to life. A lot of people go, oh, it was electricity. We've definitely got those strong images of, you know, lightning hitting the tower. That was absolutely from the 1940s.
That's just the movie, isn't it?
Yeah, in the book, it is, I think she made the right decision. It is kept intentionally vague, even though, well, some Frankenstein scholars theorize that she was inspired by hearing about Galvani's experiments.
Ah, Franken scholars.
I was originally, before doing Prometheus by Minute, I was going to do a Frankenstein podcast.
Oh my.
In which I reviewed every single depiction of Frankenstein ever. But it's just so... It's a very scholarly topic, and I got really overwhelmed really fast because...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just talking about Frankenstein, the book, and then Mary Shelley's life, and she really lived in this intersection of history, a very crucial history, a point in history that, you know, all her relationships, her parents, her suitors, her husband, all were profoundly influential. So I just went, I don't know where to even start with this. And then I decided to do Prometheus by Minute instead.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
But it's kind of tangentially related, and especially when I get to Alien Covenant, I can bring all of this information to the game.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot more Frankenstein-y. I just remembered that, yeah.
So, above all, the electricity probe, whatever, it ends in a really gruesome climax, and I think that's the important thing. Like, who gives a shit? Like, oh, would you really do that? It's not. It's sort of secondary. I've had this thesis, if you will, for a while now that I believe Ridley was very knowingly making a big budget movie with the spirit of a B-grade horror sci-fi. And arguably, I think the same could be said for Alien, that if you've ever read Dan O'Bannon's script, it's very cheesy. It's very much a complete B-grade thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Like, if it wasn't for those visuals and for the out of body, you know, like out of script, out of body, like tone and all that kind of stuff that was provided by people like Ridley Scott and him and H.R. Giger's work and the cinematography and the production design and the way it was all put together, you wouldn't have that this kind of movie at all. Because just with the script, I don't think it would hold up. I'm not saying anything against Dan O'Bannon, because I think that he brought a lot of stuff to the table when it comes to having Alien be the way it is. So
there's... Yeah, he's an interesting one to me, because I go, he had these ideas. I think that I know a lot of people like that. I think I'm one of those people where I've got the concepts, but I just don't have the experience, or I just don't know how to make this come together tonally or visually or whatever it is. Like, I think, and that's why film is great, because it's a collaborative medium.
Yeah.
Is O'Bannon clearly had something to show the world, but he couldn't do it by himself. He wasn't, one of these people who, and they're very rare, the people who can write and direct and have a good eye for cinematography and all that sort of stuff. Very few people can do that. Even the most professional directors. Directing might be the only thing.
It's not me.
But yeah, it really is fascinating to me that we are talking about Alien for all these decades, and it's still a popular franchise, mostly down to the visuals and the execution of the idea. I don't think there are too many other stories like that where...
Yeah.
Maybe Jaws is another one where the story itself isn't revolutionary, but the way it was handled made it something more than it was ever intended to be.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Jaws... that traumatized me as a kid because I watched it when I was 4.
Yeah, it's a little early. And so to bring this minute to a close, we end on a rare moment, actually rare moments for both Vickers and David. They both seem worried and uncertain as the head seems to come to life.
And I love how that head is writhing in agony, just that face
And bubbling
of, Yeah, and feeling like it's alive, like it's in pain. And I like that a lot because it's obviously dead, but it's showing reflections of life.
The locus coeruleus was the area that Shaw wanted them to activate. And apparently...
I'm more of a Maximus Decimus Meridius fan myself.
Apparently, that is the center for... Or that is where the fear... response or the shock response comes from. So she really was looking for a kind of very broad expression, maybe. I mean, I'm not a neurobiologist, but I guess that's why they picked that region, at least from a script perspective. A little bit of behind the scenes trivia that I found from the Art of Prometheus book. They covered the head with talcum powder, and there's a photo of Ridley applying that himself on set. And he does that all the time, actually. He loves to really get involved in all departments. In the original Alien, he actually went along with gold spray paint. Because they filmed in roughly chronological order, and in the final scenes, because the lighting changes and it becomes more claustrophobic and dark, he actually sprayed the hallways with gold because he knew how that would play out on screen and really retain the depth that is only visible.
Nice.
Yeah. Which I take that information from Alien Minute, but you know, we're all related.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, exactly.
And the same sort of thing happens with talcum powder. Apparently, it creates this luminous quality. And it really does. There's this sort of fluorescent look to it almost. So if you don't have anything else for this minute, I think we should wrap this up.
No, I think we talked about everything. I think we pretty much went through the entire minute. So the only thing I can say is Numi's so pretty.
Yeah.
That's it.
She has a really sculptural face. I think
yes,
that's what I want to say.
Yes.
Very angular. She's very
her cheekbones her cheeks are very pronounced.
Yeah, it's a good face. I should draw her at some point. Just the nose and the brow. She's got everything going on. That about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. And Phil, where can we find you?
The most relevant place, because we're talking on a podcast, is all the other podcasts that I'm in, which there are only two. And the first one is the most relevant, which is The Matrix Minute. That is thematrixminute.1. I got it right this time. I always get it wrong when we're on the podcast, but it's now a retired and soon to be fossilized podcast, but it's still good. It's still good because The Matrix is a film that came out in 1999 and we just made a podcast about it in 2017. There's really no need to not listen to it. But we also have another podcast called Phil and Jake in Conversation, and that's where just me and my brother Jacob talk about random things and movies and life in general, and that's going to be done soon. So you can go there too. It's Phil and just Google search it. Phil and Jake in Conversation. And if you Google me, you'll find out a bunch of information. So there we go. That's me. I'm neat.
Your shows, honestly, I think you have a good rapport with your family, of course. But
thanks.
Yeah, it's always really entertaining. I think those are some of my favorite Movies by Minute podcasts. And
yes!
I think it really is just, you have the knowledge and you have, you know, filmmaking experience as well. You guys got great personalities. You play off each other really well.
Aww,
and
thanks.
Yeah, I recommend the show.
I'm not sure. Right. I think you're quite knowledgeable yourself. Like, I was not expecting so much information going in when we were talking about this movie. Excellent.
I am autistic, so I get a little obsessed with things.
And this is me, Phil, signing off.